So now it's time for questions. There should be a portable mic available for the questions. Who has that? Who is the person who is dealing with recording this? So what I want is to keep the mic here. Keep the mic here, or there could be one here and one here, and queue up to ask. It works much better this way than carrying the mic up. If you could hold the mic here so that people can come here and queue up to ask questions. This system is much better than carrying the mic across the room. It takes so much time. It's so boring. And not only that, if you queue up, it's always fair because you'll get your turn to ask your question. You don't have to worry about whether I'll see you. It's, come on, come on. And do speak loud because I'm a bit hard of hearing.
You spoke a little bit about the economic model that would support artists and so ensure the freedom.
Well, I suggested a few.
But in terms of software, particularly in terms of, because it takes a lot of time off into research.
Well, actually, we don't have the problem so much in software because we're already making lots of free software. Now, the methods I proposed for supporting artists, it's hard to adapt them to software. And the reason is, with software, you often have so many contributors that the problem of deciding how to divide that money would be very, very hard. If you could stand next to them. Oh, I see, there's someone over there. Okay. Okay. Sure.
I love your idea of having a button to push to pay small amounts of money for things. But, I mean, have you examined how this is going to work? I mean, how much does something like PayPal actually take from...
I think it's around 50% for small payments with PayPal. And you have to identify yourself,
exactly,
too.
Exactly, that's another problem. I mean, I like to use free software. Or shareware, where you're supposed.
Well, shareware.
They offer you to give them some money voluntarily, but the difficulty is actually giving them the money.
I agree.
Now, you've got to invent that you're a genius.
Well, the technology has been invented. The technology already exists. The problem is at the social level, getting it put into use. Technology for anonymous digital cash exists already. But I should point out that shareware typically is not free software. The users don't get the source code, they can't change it, they can't study it. So it's just as unethical as the proprietary software. I wouldn't use it if they paid me to.
Thank you. You've spoken a lot about economic rights and restrictions on the term.
I didn't talk about economic rights. I've talked about restrictions on citizens. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a bit more to copyright than just simply economics. There's also the dignity of the author. There's a whole load of rights called moral rights.
I already addressed that, I think.
Have you?
Yes.
I mean, you're right to not to be misrepresented, right not to be aware.
Yes, I did. I addressed that.
Okay.
But remember, you can deal with not misrepresenting someone by marking modified versions. Quoting passages is a useful thing and should be allowed, which is different from publishing a modified version of the work.
Well, that's... a different sort of thing altogether. That's a limitation to the extent of the monopoly. What makes sense?
Yes. Well, I'm talking about reducing the monopoly somewhat,
yeah,
in different ways for different kinds of works. For a work that does a practical job, it's not representing anybody at all. That's not part of it. That's not part of its contribution to society. On the other hand, a statement of opinion is representing someone.
Okay, I'll accept that.
Hi, shouldn't the designs of everything be free? Everything's designed these days, I expect, by computer. You were talking earlier about audio recorder how...
Okay, may I respond?
Okay.
It wouldn't do us any good if the design of that were free, because we don't have a way to turn that design into an object. That may change in, you know, people are starting to make cheap 3D printers, but they can only print plastic. In 50 years, maybe we'll have personal fabricators that we can use to make the digital hardware we want. And in that case, yes, it will be absolutely essential for the designs to be free.
Okay, I mean, as you said, this is beginning now with fab labs and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, well, the designs for those have to be free. The designs for functional objects, the designs to be printed out as functional objects, those must be free. And the designs for decorative or artistic objects, well, those must be shareable. In other words, I think that the same three categories of my recommendations for them will be appropriate for new technologies if some additional area of life enters into the area where we can copy. Then I believe these same conclusions will apply. But today, for most physical objects, it's just irrelevant because we can't fabricate them ourselves.
Well, when things break, you can't make things to fix them. You know, if you need a little thing to fix something, you usually have to throw the whole thing away. If something little goes wrong in your printer, you need a tiny bit of plastic. You can't just make it and... Well, I just think the designs
well,
of
the thing you need
free,
to
so
make
everyone's free to improve designs.
The thing you need to make to fix your printer might well not be a part of the printer. I don't know. But in any case, the 3D printers today print a particular kind of plastic which might well not be what your printer's made of. Basically, 3D printing is just in its infancy today. And I think it's a mistake to try to demand a solution today for a problem of the future. It's unnecessarily hard. Let's solve the problem of the future with future technology.
There is a problem with resource limits, with environmental destruction. We're basically trashing the planet. If humanity continues the course it's on,
yeah, but that's a different issue.
Well, I think if the designs of everything were free, we'd be able to produce stuff more efficiently.
But most stuff we can't.
Most stuff ends up in the landfill.
Sorry, those are two separate things.
Everything produced ends up in the landfill.
Those are separate issues. There's no reason to think that we would affect the landfills very much based on whether the designs of certain things are available for 3D printers. So little is being made with 3D printers now. The point is, you're talking about a problem that may be important in the future, and I'm saying, let's cross that bridge when we come to it.
But if the designs were free, then anyone could make things. It wouldn't only be...
No, actually, you're a mistake. That's mistaken. No, that's not true.
Why not?
Most things can only be made in a factory. The 3D printers can make a limited, tiny subset of the things we make. And that's why, for most things, this issue wouldn't have any effect.
Well, I'd like to be able to buy an open-source washing machine.
Well, I don't want anything to be open-source. The point is, you can't make a washing machine that way yet. 3D printers are not up to it.
Well, you're the one that brought up 3D printers, aren't they?
Right. Well, 3D printers are the beginning of personal fabrication. And they're just at a beginning stage now, and it's very limited what they can make. So, given how limited they are, they're not enough to make a powerful argument about how to make washing machines. People are not going to be making their washing machines in the next 10 years with 3D printers, if they've got a design. Maybe in 50 years they will. In 50 years, a free design for a washing machine might be part of what we need. But the point is, you're anticipating things, and the anticipating is the mistake. We don't need to try to demand now the things that we might need in 50 years, because we don't know what things will be like in 50 years. We don't know what we'll need, and in 50 years, if technological change means we need more, technological change will also help us get it. And so it's wasteful to try to solve the possible anticipated problems of 50 years from now with today's technology today. It may be a lot easier to solve those problems in 50 years. Let's wait till then.
Well, God knows what the planet will be like in 50 years.
That's right, but there's no point. You didn't get my point. No, so I won't repeat it. I guess it's time for the next person.
Well, I don't think you've got the question's point either.
Well, I think I did. Tough. What can I say? I've said all the response I've got. I don't have a different response to give.
Are you through talking?
Am I through talking? I'm not ready. I'm not calling a halt to this event.
You've said as much as you have to say on that particular point.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you for this brilliant talk. My point is you mentioned about the burning of the Quran, and this is a book which says there is no compulsion on religion. Basically, it frees the whole humanity if they reject it or accept it. My question is, would you support to burn a book which basically gives freedom to the people? And
I support the freedom to burn any book at all, as long as it's your copy.
Well, yeah.
Linus Torvald said to people that they should print out the GNU coding standards and burn them. Well, he has a right to. I mean, I might feel insulted, but well, people have a right to insult me or anybody.
Okay. What do you think about patent when it comes to that?
I don't want to talk about patents today because patents and copyrights have nothing to do with each other. Now, and if I talked about patents today, I would be supporting the widespread mistaken idea that they are similar. They're not similar, they're totally unrelated. Why would anyone ever confuse them? It's the fashion to confuse them, to lump them together. There is a fashionable term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, which tries to generalize about a dozen or more different laws, copyright being one and patent law being another. Well, these laws are totally different. They have nothing in common. And it's any statement formulated in terms of, quote, intellectual property, unquote, is confusion. So, but that confusion has influenced many people. And they see other people using this term and they think, this is the way we're supposed to speak today, so I have to use this term too. And as a result, they make their statements vague. I want to be careful not to encourage that mistaken practice. I have given a talk about copyright law. I've said a number of things that relate to copyright law. They don't have anything to do with patent law. Patent law is a totally different topic. And I'd rather not talk about it today because people would think they have something to do with each other.
Well, the thing is, you mentioned about the three freedoms 0, 1, and 2, and 3.
Yeah.
Which are basically not allowed when people patent their product.
Patents are an important issue, but it's an issue unrelated to today's issue.
But it's related to freedom, right?
Well, the thing is,
thank you.
You can even listen to the speech I've given about the danger of software patents because recordings are available in audio-video.gnu.org. And I think there's something about that in the book, although you should double check. So I hope that will give some answers, but I don't want to talk about it in this talk.
Richard, before the next question, can I grab your check?
Yeah, that would be nice.
Basically, I'm not sure of whether I'm in the loop or not, but I believe that following the DMCA, there was certain attempts by a senator of Utah, Orrin Hatch, to tighten the screws even further.
They keep tightening the screws in the U.S., and not just there. In Europe, there's a wave of laws authorizing governments to shut down network servers without even a trial. So there are lots of different things that nasty things that have been proposed as tactics in the war on sharing.
Okay, but the core of my question was, is that you say that a lot of this comes from influential business, and sort of what I want to ask is, what's the inertia? Do governments, when given these proposals, do they carry them out fairly autonomously as democratically elected benevolent systems, or do they require external force to...
Well, I don't know the details, and it probably varies, but in the U.S. government, the Congress people and senators need lots of money to run for re-election, and indirectly they get this money from business. And there's a well-developed system of lobbying where they know who's going to get them the money that they'll need, and they know what they have to do for those businesses in order to get it, which means, although I have no basis to assume that they're doing this in a way that's illegal, but the laws, you know, the laws forbid certain things. They know how to skirt those laws and effectively be corrupt.
All right, thank you. My question was regarding Sony Computer Entertainment on the PlayStation 3. The failover.
I have trouble hearing the sounds you make.
Sorry.
If you speak slower, I could hear you better.
Sorry, it's just a nervousness problem. My question was regarding the failover team and the hacker known as GeoHot. One team of hackers opened up PlayStation 3 to the point where they could run their own applications and code, and that was enough for homebrew, and everyone was pretty happy with that. And then GeoHot came along and extended the jailbreak to the point where it could be used to infringe Sony's copyright as much as you have disdained.
I don't know if it's infringing Sony's copyright.
But
where do you get that conclusion?
It was from statements by the failover flow team and GeoHot himself. It was allowing users to run pirated copies of video games, whereas the modifications made by the failover flow team only allowed homebrew code, with the exception of backup media, if you see my point.
So this means you could also run your own game?
Yes, that was the extension that GeoHot made. I was wondering where you drew the line when it came to, because basically you can already run your own code, and then Sony went after GeoHot and is now trying to hold him into court, basically, for what he's done.
Well, sharing should be legal. Sharing copies of any published work should be legal.
I guess that's all we see. Okay. Fair enough.
Thank you. Is it fair to say during your talk you referred to some corporations as megacorps and systems bastards as well? I don't know whether you relate to
that. Well, that's... I don't remember when I said that. I think I was talking specifically about companies that convinced our governments to make laws to attack our freedom in order to help them.
So when you say megacorp, is that because you feel they're too big, or... you have,
well, the bigger they are, the more political influence they have, typically.
So it's more because the way they interact with the political and citizen community sphere.
Well, that's what's bad. That's what I'm criticizing.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Calling them, the term mega corporation just refers to their size.
Yeah. Is it in general you see that, you cited a few that started conspiracies, as you call them. But do you have any example of non-conspiratorial megacorps that you feel is beneficial?
I don't know. In general, I think that it's dangerous to allow such large companies to exist because they get power by being so large, and then they make threats against governments. And you can see the effects of that around the UK right now. So they were able to make a financial crisis. I guess you see it even worse in Ireland now. Companies made a financial crisis, and the people are going to pay. So why is it that the people are going to pay? It's because powerful entities said, we won't let you make the depositors in these failed banks pay. Of course, you know, it's good to insure deposits of individuals up to a certain point so that they don't become impoverished. But beyond that, why should the people have to pay the debts that these private banks had contracted? Well, they were pressured. The government was pressured to do something that was going to hurt the country for a long time. But you can see over and over policies that benefit business in various different ways at the expense of people generally. And business can do this because it has political influence. And the bigger businesses get, the more political influence they have, they get to be considered too big to fail. Well, any business that's too big to fail threatens us all. So we need to make these businesses smaller, like make them split up into multiple businesses that are not so big and they're not too big to fail. That's one solution. There are various ways to achieve this. The point is that in our political system today, when people talk about a problem, the people talking about it mostly want a certain outcome, and they mention the problem as an argument for the outcome they want, which usually is more subsidy for business, less regulation of business, people in general being trampled more. And so they mention that the business is too big to fail when it's in danger of failing. And the rest of the time they don't say, this business is too big to fail, we're having reasonably good times now, let's do something to make it split up so that if anything were to go wrong in the future, it wouldn't be too big to fail. And it wouldn't cause us a big problem if it does fail.
I'd like to ask you a question about what we as an audience and all the rest of the members of the public can do to actually practically make this stuff happen. I think that we'd all, those that agree with you, would join your campaigns and try and apply political pressure to our governments to change copyright law to actually follow the principles you've been mentioning. But also, would you say that at the moment, as copyright is as it is, creatives and people producing works should actually go for things like the Creative Commons licenses and
yes, but you can do more than that. For instance, keep your Wi-Fi networks open. Don't be conscripted into being an enforcer in the war on sharing. Collective responsibility is a favorite tactic of tyrants. And various governments are trying to pressure people to put passwords on their wireless networks so that everybody's kept divided and everybody can be kept under control. By having an open wireless network, you resist. Now, if somebody else is using so much of your bandwidth that it's hard for you to get work done, I understand you've got to do something about that. But there are various things you can try to do. Just putting a password on it permanently could be the last resort. And sometimes, if your neighbor is really obnoxious, you may need to do that. But maybe you don't need to do that. Maybe talking to your neighbors would be enough to avoid that and solve your practical problem. So give it a try. think of this as a form of protest. And I think that alternative voting is also important for this, because that would enable people to much more effectively express their support for a political party that says, we're going to end the war on sharing.
Great. And could you actually point to, is there already a project to do micropayments thing you were talking about?
I didn't talk about micropayments.
Well, you know,
a quarter of a pound is not a micropayment. It's a small but substantial payment. The term micropayments usually refers to something different, yeah. Namely compulsory payments that you have no choice about. I'm not in favor of that, because that's part of a system of DRM. So please don't call this micropayments and give people the wrong idea. But the technology for things like that exists. The hard part is getting it adopted. And I don't know how to do that. I can only propose it as an idea.
Are you suggesting that I should go and search myself rather than you actually giving me a name of a project?
I don't have any name to give you in.
Flutter.com.
What?
Thank you.
Flutter.com.
Well, that's something somewhat similar in that it's a way, it's also a project to make it easier for people to voluntarily give to some artists. So in its general spirit, it's similar, but in the details, it's different.
Hi. Apologies if I'm missing the point a bit. In what you're talking about, it's going to, if it all comes about, bring around change. Now, change scares a lot of people. So is it right for us that want freedom to scare people?
I don't understand.
Because we want or we feel that we want change. That means that business will be done differently, governments will work, talk slightly differently. These changes, I personally think, will scare some people. Some people.
I think that's right.
But is it fair for our greater good to scare people? You can't
put
people in
fear. Are you saying that... I don't understand. I don't follow. Are you proposing that we should go out of our way to scare people as a political tactic?
No. Sorry.
I don't understand.
Sorry. What I'm saying is, as change happens, as large.
Are you saying
that
you think that people should never propose a change that anyone might be scared of? Because I don't think that's true. And lots of other changes that are much nastier are being proposed, that changes that are going to hurt people a lot. And the right wing has no hesitation to propose changes like that. I don't think that the change I'm proposing is really going to hurt society, but some people may have less of the income that they're now getting, and so they may be not as well off. I don't think that's an argument against it. And if some other people who wouldn't in fact be hurt might be scared that they would lose something, well, the sensible thing to do is explain to them that they wouldn't. And then they'll be less scared. That could be a useful thing to do. But when something is doing real harm, the fact that ending this might make somebody worry about some discomfort, I don't think is a reason we shouldn't end the real harm.
Thank you.
My question is about progress and innovation. Do you think we'd be where we are today with sort of digital integration of just about everything, and most people are on computer without large commercially driven companies?
I don't know, but I don't think it matters. I'm more concerned about our freedom as software users than about how much software use we're doing. Because that people are using software and computing can be good or bad. We shouldn't base our thinking on the presumption that that's good. I'm not trying, I don't think we should try to maximize how much computing is done. Computing may be useful, but I don't think it's a good thing to have unless it respects our freedom as well as being convenient. So I would like to have as much useful free software developed as possible and have as little proprietary software exist as possible. That's my idea of the criterion we should try to maximize.
All right, thanks.
Do you think it's a danger that a lot of computers are being hidden behind terms of appliance? So, for example, an ebook reader is not sold as a computer, and therefore users don't expect to be able to do the things which it can do, which they would otherwise expect if it were, say, a desktop. And the same with phones and with music players, which are locked down, but which
First of all, a lot of phones, this is a complicated issue, and what you said is not entirely true. First of all, there are some things which are appliances which happen to be built using computers, or maybe they're built using computers, and maybe they have software in them, but it makes no difference to us. And I don't see that we need to be concerned about that. Then there are other things like smartphones, which are general purpose computers, and users are installing software on them all the time, and I think users are more and more aware that they are general purpose computers. So I would rather describe that by saying this is another kind of general purpose computer that users are using. And then there are things that are sort of on the boundary, where it's possible to install software in something, but it isn't the normal use. And I think it's just barely okay to think of those as appliances. But some of these devices are malicious. That's a separate question from whether they are computers and you deserve free software in them and deserve to be able to change the software any way you like.
It's not about the computer or the software, it's about the freedom to use it as you...
Right, well, the point is some of these devices are malicious and they're designed to restrict what you can do. And that's nasty, whether the device is a computer or an appliance or whatever.
The type of device is irrelevant if you haven't got the freedom to...
Yeah, and my point was that users a lot of the time are, I would say, duped into expecting less from their device as it's marketed as an appliance.
That's buying the wrong device, then.
Maybe. I'm not sure. I tend to think of that as a side issue, and I don't have strong opinions about it. If they're really being lied to, well, it's not good to lie. But on the other hand, the fact that there is a processor chip in something, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad that processor chip is being put to doing one specific kind of job, and it's not the job of running programs for you. To be a general purpose computer is not about how something is built. It's about what job it does for you. A general purpose computer is a platform for installing programs to do lots of different things. And so that's different from an appliance. And so they may have the same processor chip. In other words, I'm saying this distinction between what is presented to you as a platform for running programs and the appliance is a real difference, even if they have the same processor in them. But malicious appliances are just as nasty as malicious computers.
Could you share your thoughts on the relevance of software freedom in the larger context? I mean, it's not only freedom, along with the DMC and many other laws were passed around the world, not just in the US, that attack our freedom in more fundamental ways. How useful is it to have software freedom if you don't address?
Well, there are many areas of life where freedom issues arise. And one of these freedoms doesn't replace the other. We need them all. So now that software and compute, more properly speaking, computing, is an important part of our lives, another freedom we need is the freedom to control our computing. But this doesn't eliminate the need for all the freedoms we needed 50 years ago. Those issues are still just as important as they were. So I don't think that free software automatically makes a regime just. Having some free software in China doesn't make the regime just. Having some free software in the UK doesn't make the regime just. We have to fight for the other freedoms too. And nasty things can be done with computing that we can't solve by having control over our own computers. For instance, the Stalinistic system of surveillance in the UK keeps track of everybody's car travel. Now, that I consider intolerable, and people should not be tolerating it. We can't fix that by doing anything with our own computers, because that surveillance is being done by the state's computers. But that doesn't make it any less tyrannical. It has to be hard for the police to investigate. It has to be just barely doable enough that they can do it when it needs to be done. And no easier, because if it's any easier, then they become a threat. And this threat has been seen over and over again in the streets of this country in the past few months.
Richard, I know you're very concerned about education, and I wonder whether you see a danger in terms of a de-educated population using computers, such that a typical computer user will have, for example, no idea what source code is. Perhaps they'll not even have any understanding of, you know, what software is.
I really don't know. That's too long term for me to claim to know whether that's a real danger or not. I would expect that today the fraction of people who learn what software is increasing, and the fraction of people who learn how to work on software is increasing. Whether there's a danger that that might disappear, sorry, that's one of those future possible problems that I'm going to leave till the future, till we see if it's really going to happen. Because we're not in a position today to figure out how to prevent that problem if it's going to happen.
You suggested earlier that...
Could you come and use the microphone, please?
Suggested earlier that it's not really in our interest to run software on like appliances, for example, where they're not general purpose.
No, I didn't say that. What I said is that's not part of their normal use.
Okay.
I'm not going to say that it is outright wrong to make an appliance which has a processor in it, but it's designed to do a particular thing. I don't want to be that radical.
So what I've been right in suggesting that one of the freedoms isn't the freedom of compiling and executing code on any hardware that we choose.
I wouldn't go so far, but on the other hand, I think it's nasty of them to actually try to stop you. my microwave oven might have a processor in it, or it might not. I don't know. It makes no difference to me as a user of the microwave oven whether it's built using a processor or with some special kind of control chip that doesn't have a processor in it. on the other hand, it would be nasty for them to stop you from taking the microwave oven apart and putting a program in there. So the point is, what I do not say the software in that microwave oven, if there is any, must be free. I don't object to the fact that they didn't say how they built it. They didn't, and if it is a processor, evidently they didn't give me source code for the code in it. But I don't complain about that because that code doesn't impinge on me. On the other hand, if you really want to take that microwave oven apart and see if it's got a program in there and write a program for it, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think it would be wrong for them to do things to stop you. And nowadays, that's becoming a more and more common practice. And if a device has a computer in it, but it's not a computer, they still shouldn't maliciously try to stop you from installing software into it.
Thank you for your time.
My question is regarding, because in most of the universities, as you mentioned, people teach the proprietary softwares like languages, you know, from Microsoft, maybe some other companies as well. What could be done to let the universities throughout the world know the best way for them to teach their students is through the free software?
It's not easy. Of course, in my free software speeches, I explain at greater length the reasons why education should only teach free software. But if you're asking, practically speaking, how do you succeed in getting them to change, there is no easy way. You have to organize and keep organizing more people and teach more people to demand this, including students, including faculty, and always present the issue as an ethical one. If they try to make it be about just practical things, you have to say, no, the question here is, what's a good or a bad thing for a school to do? And working together with the allies you found, you'll keep looking for new ways, and you might succeed, because some people have succeeded in some places. But I don't know, I wish I could tell you, follow these rules and you'll succeed, but it's not that easy.
Maybe we have to try to develop in all universities the free software societies.
Yes, but the point is that the free software society should explicitly say, this university should not teach proprietary software, it's wrong to do that. And most of the free software organizations that exist right now don't go that far, and they need to go that far.
I've tried to implement a GNU Linux system in a secondary school, and I met up with barrier after barrier against it. For instance, a zero cost for implementing this was met with an excuse that it couldn't be documented
It was met with something?
It was met with an excuse that they couldn't account for it because it had a zero value, you know.
Offer to sell it to them for £1.
I did do that, and then they come up with another barrier that they are tied into an IT policy or document that prohibits free open source free software. And
I don't know if that's true.
And then I met with, well, we can't get it electrically tested and all kinds of...
That's ridiculous. You can run this...
It won't.
Well, the point is, you need to organize people who are going to tell that person, we don't want you here.
Yeah. People laugh, but I take it is serious like that. Yeah, it is.
They need to say, when are you going to teach our children to be decent people?
Well, I've taken it to the next step now in that I've got my own children, and at their primary school, I've actually taken that step and gone in and said, I'd like you to implement free source software. You know, and explain the difference in freedom between price and the rights, the freedom of the rights. And I think people at this particular school have started realising that it's wrong to be using proprietary software and tying children and their minds into a proprietary mindset, you know.
Absolutely. And you might conceivably find some of the things I've written useful to show to those people. They're in GNU.org.
I've actually got a copy of Free Software, Free Society, and I do show that to some of the teachers in this particular school.
Also, it's conceivable that some of the recordings of my free software speeches, which you can find in audio-video.gnu.org, that they might help you persuade some of these people, because I always touch on free software and education.
It's very difficult when you get face-to-face with the IT boss, as it were, in any establishment, that they're already pre-programmed, as you say, in a proprietary mentality, and the walls around them stop them seeing the value of free software.
The crucial thing is, don't let the decision be up to them. So go to the people above them and say and argue, for this school to be doing a good job of educating, it needs to teach freedom-respecting software and stop teaching dependence. And if you convince them, then they talk to the... And he says, well, if he says, well, this is an IT thing and I don't understand it, so I'll let my IT expert think about it. You have to immediately say, no, this is not a technical question. This is an ethical question.
I've actually done that, but used the technology as a lever to get my point made by my daughter doing homework and sending it into school in a free format, which the school have got to accept. They can't not accept her homeworks in a free format. So the IT guy is going to have to implement a free source.
Or at least some way that they
can look at it. Free document. The way I can do it is that he has to use a free source program, because that's the only one that supports the free format.
Well, of course, there's nothing to stop them from using it. But in any case, it sounds like you've done a good job, first of all, and you've come up with a lot of effective methods. So congratulations and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
But I'm trying to mention how to cope with some problems that you are likely to encounter from time to time, such as the head of the organization wants to delegate the decision to a technical expert. And then you have to say, no, that's a mistake. He's an expert on the technology you're using now, but he's not accustomed to even considering the question I'm discussing with you, which is an ethical question about whether that technology is an ethical one, and what the school should be doing to educate people in a good way. So you've got to argue you've got to show why that technical expert is the wrong person to make this decision, and why you shouldn't listen to him when he says, we can't do this, because he wants it to fail. He doesn't want to try to succeed.
Even if it's unknowingly, he still is making it fail.
Yeah, well, the point is, none so blind as he will not see. So he doesn't want to see a path to move to free software, so he thinks there is none. I'm not saying he's intentionally, consciously lying, but he isn't going to see a way to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the point that needs to be made to people above him, or people with independent influence, like the parents of the students in the school, so that eventually they say, if this is the job that needs to be done, and if you're saying you can't do it, I guess we need to replace you with someone who can, right?
Yeah. Hello. You outlined your suggestions for the copyright regime for the three different types of published works. Are there any existing licenses, maybe GPL or Creative Commons, that would actually allow creators of works to voluntarily follow this regime?
Yes. In fact, for artistic works, I think any of the Creative Commons licenses is okay, because all of them at least give the freedom to share. Now, some of the Creative Commons licenses are free licenses. And so for the works that need to be free, you could use those. For software, though, you should use a free software license. Particularly, you should use a free software license that's at least compatible with GNU GPL version 3 in future. Okay, are you coming to ask a question? This will be the last one. So here's Mike.
You didn't seem to like, since you not interfered with the start of the
question. That's right.
Economic security for freedom of thought.
Well,
without freedom of secure expression, freedom of thought is meaningless. And when we forget how to express ourselves and think, do we not tend, as you always lean towards a loss of education and forgetfulness of the use of writing for itself?
Theoretically, that sounds plausible, but I don't see that it's a totally different issue. And I don't know if I have much to add to what other people have said elsewhere about that issue. Of course, I'm in favor of the freedom of thought, but, and just as I defend freedom of expression of the thoughts, but I'm not sure it directly relates to this.
Only insofar as your free thinking seems to neglect any sense of its own security in its distribution, the sense of
carbon-silicon
symbiosis in the machine.
I don't know what security of distribution means, or it's not a combination I've heard before.
A sense of survival of the mind.
Well, again, that's very general, and I'm not sure there are people who say that using the internet leads to people who can't think clearly or as much, but I'm not convinced that's actually true. And the other thing is that the effects on our thinking of computer use out of other technological media, they seem to change every few decades. I mean, television was doing one thing to people, which I suspect was really bad, and using computers is not doing that same bad thing to people's thinking. Maybe it's better, but it'll take time for us to find out if there's something, some bad aspect.
Keep changing the tablets, you could go with advanced methods in chaos to create a different, better future.
I guess so. I don't know. The point is, this is outside what I think I know something about.
I wouldn't want to draw you out of your mind as well.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for today. I hope you'll all join me in thanking Richard very much for giving up his time.